Hello, and welcome to tonight's event. My name is Pat Andriola, and I'm the president of the Free Thought Society here at Tufts University. The Free Thought Society is a student-run group which promotes free thought, which is the use of science and reason in all areas. Tonight we have come together to see two authorities in their respective fields discuss and debate the topic of God with the resolution, God is a man-made invention. Our first speaker, Daniel Dennett, is the Austin B. Fletcher Professor of Philosophy here at Tufts. Professor Dennett is a graduate of Harvard University who earned his PhD in philosophy from Oxford. A world-renowned philosopher and one of the four horsemen of atheism, Professor Dennett has explained his view on religion as a natural phenomenon in his best-selling book, Breaking the Spell. While giving the Richard Dawkins Award for 2007, the namesake of the award described Professor Dawkins as his intellectual hero. Tonight, Professor Dennett will be affirming the resolution. Dinesh D'Souza is the Robert and Karen Rishwain Fellow at the Hoover Institute at Stanford University. A Phi Beta Kappa graduate at Dartmouth College, D'Souza served as a policy advisor to Ronald Reagan and is now the author of numerous best-selling books, including his latest, What's So Great About Christianity? Mr. D'Souza, a noted conservative Christian, once commented that atheism is the real force behind the mass murders of history. UNC Wilmington Professor Mike Adams called Dinesh D'Souza perhaps the greatest political mind of our time. Mr. D'Souza will be negating the resolution. I wanted to thank our generous sponsors, the Intercollegiate Studies Institute, the Center for Inquiry, the Secular Student Alliance, and ToTheSource.org. Also, I would like to thank Tufts University for helping organize the debate. Each has helped in making sure a great debate like tonight could take place. Finally, I ask you to please turn off all your cell phones and welcome tonight's moderator, Provost Jamshed Barucha.
Good evening. This is really Tufts at its finest. We have in store for us a spectacular debate involving two of the most distinguished authors of our time. One of the great privileges of education, and certainly of being a student at Tufts, is that you get to witness something like this, and you have an excuse not to be writing your papers and studying for your exams. Both authors and speakers tonight really have had an impact that goes way beyond what is typical, either of an author based at a university or a writer who's not. And we have one of each in this group. And they've come really from very, very different tracks. And so I think it is particularly interesting that we should see these two come together to debate. Let me tell you a little bit about the format. We will start with up to 25 minutes from each speaker. We will start with Dan Dennett, who will take the affirmative position, and then we will start. Then we will go to Dinesh D'Souza, who will take the negative, and then there will be a 5-minute rebuttal by each one, and then a second round of rebuttals. Okay, so really, 4 sets of 5 minutes each, and I will time them. And following that, we will have questions from the audience. Each of the debaters will have an opportunity to comment on each question. And I would urge you, as you plan your questions, to make sure that, number one, they are indeed questions, and number two, that they are very brief. And I can assure you that our debaters as well will try to be brief in their responses so we can get as many questions in as we can. So after the Q&A, we will try to end around 9. If it spills over a little bit and people are still, you know, steamed up and ready to go, we might go a little bit beyond. The speakers are willing to do that, but not too much beyond 9 o'clock. There will be a book signing outside, and one of our student organizers will be up here to make some closing remarks. I want to finally close by congratulating our students for really organizing this event. Things like this are absolutely the best if they're by students, for students. So thank you all to the students. And now let's begin with Dan Dennett.
I need to push some button here.
Might have to use this now.
I'll get out of the way. There we go.
And this is all right.
Okay. Everybody can hear? Thanks very much, Jamshed. I'm delighted to be here. The topic is God, a Human Invention was not my choice of topic. This was proposed actually by Dinesh, and I'm going along with it. And I'll say a little bit more about what I was going to have as my topic, because as he said in his proposal to me, we can do both topics at once. First, let's just get a few facts on the table so that we have something properly to reason about. Here you see a map of the world, and it just shows, this is, I suppose, somewhat out of date. It shows the world's religions color-coded. So Islam is in green, and Buddhism is in purple. Hinduism is in brown. Christianity is in yellow. And according to the World Christian Encyclopedia, which is really the sort of authoritative book about this, the only religion that's growing today of these major categories is Islam. And it's growing almost entirely by a differential birth rate, not by conversion in. I know there's a sense out there that say Christianity must be booming, must be growing too, but there's really no evidence of that. For instance, the Southern Baptists now are baptizing about the same number they were back in the 50s each year. There's really no change in membership. And there was a nice piece in the New York Times this just about a year ago, October 2006, about the National Association of Evangelicals, which had a study. They were really worried that youth were falling away from the evangelical churches at a great rate, quoting one of them. If current trends continue, only 4% of teenagers will be Bible-believing Christians as adults. So I think you should temper your hunch that religions are growing at a great rate in this country. What they are doing, I think, is growing louder. But not necessarily growing in numbers. They're becoming more vocal, more aggressive, more obvious in many ways. Another point that's often made is that you'll notice on this map there's no difference shown between the United States Christianity and Europe as a Christian. This is a very sort of rough cast map. And one of the points that people always make is how much more religious the United States is than, say, Western Europe. And this is true. And one might wonder why. Maybe Dinesh will want to speak about that later, but there's one set of facts that I think everybody should have in front of them, and that is that, let's talk family values for just a minute. If you compare the United States with Western Europe, the homicide rate is much higher here than there. This sexually transmitted disease rate, much higher here than there. Teen pregnancy rate, higher here than in Europe. Also, abortion rates, higher here than in Europe. So this vision of the godless, secularized Europe being a place where family values are in deep trouble seems to be exactly wrong. Now, maybe we're more religious because we have to be because we're such sinners, but there might be other explanations of that. Now, this is a map which shows the rough breakdown of different religions. You'll see that Christianity, which includes all kinds of Christians, is by far the largest percentage of the world's religion. But notice that Islam is only slightly more than the non-religious. And there are roughly twice as many non-religious, more than twice as many, three times as many as Buddhists. And in fact, the group that's growing the fastest in the world is not Islam, it's the non-religious. Now, I like facts like this, and I think everybody should know them because there's some surprises. I think probably some of these already are facts that you didn't have under your belt. And I've made a proposal, and this is what we were going to debate about, what I propose that we debate about. My proposal for what I'm calling the fourth R, there's reading, writing, arithmetic, and I've actually proposed a compulsory curriculum on world religions for all schools. So here's my proposal, that education on world religion for all our children in public and private schools and for homeschoolers.
trying to decide in the time I have whether I should rebut Professor Bennett or Dennett or just jump into my own thoughts. I think what I'll do is touch on a couple of points that he makes and then come back in my rebuttal and address them more.
This would be compulsory. And the idea was that it would cover history, creed, rituals, music, symbols, ethical commands, and prohibitions. That's it. Just well-attested, non-controversial facts that everybody can agree to about the world's religions, and that should be a curriculum which starts in grade school, goes into middle school and high school. Now, I believe as strongly as anybody in the principle of freedom of religion. So notice that this in no way violates freedom of religion. As long as you teach your children this curriculum, you can teach them anything else you want. Anything else you want, provided it doesn't disable them from further informing themselves. So it honors the principle of freedom of religion. Now, I've been discussing this proposal since I put it in my book for a year and a half now, and I've had the support, actually, of a lot of even right-wing Christian leaders who say, this is great, you know, we're all for it. But Dinesh is on record as opposing it. Here's what he has to say. He says, Daniel Dennett urges that the schools teach religion as a purely natural phenomenon, and then he goes on to say, by this he means that religion should be taught as if it were untrue. Oh no, that's not what it means, and I've never said that. And this is simply a misrepresentation by Dinesh. I expanded on my point on the blog on faith, which some of you may have seen, and I thought it was not... It was such an obvious implication that I put it in parentheses. I said, notice that the truth or falsity of any religious doctrines would not be included in the curriculum, since not a single point of religious doctrine is agreed upon as straightforward fact by the world community. So Dinesh has misrepresented my position, and maybe that's why he is opposed to it. I don't know. Maybe now that he understands it better, he'll be in agreement of it. We'll see. Now, my reason for this is not the reason he suggests. He thinks I'm trying to wipe out religion. On the contrary, it's my recommendation for how to preserve the best in religion and get rid of just the stuff that we all want to get rid of, the toxic stuff. And it's a rather simple argument. All religions have toxic versions therein. That is, there are antisocial, fanatical elements in every major religion, in Hinduism, in Islam, in various kinds of Christianity, and so forth. And as near as I can see, this is an empirical claim. I haven't done direct research on it, but combing the literature seems to me pretty clear. All toxic versions depend on the enforced ignorance of the young. It's only by keeping your young people ignorant of other religions that you can preserve this. So my sort of public health measures say just don't permit that enforced ignorance to go on. Informing the young, we inoculate them against toxic forms of religion. And my understanding of this is as follows. A religion that can survive under this sort of free information deserves to survive. It's a benign form of religion. Let it flourish. And a religion that can't survive without the enforced ignorance of the young deserves to go extinct. But I don't know. Maybe Dinesh disagrees with that. We'll see. He quotes me. This is something Dinesh does in his book. He quotes in a context of disparagement, but you're never quite sure if he agrees with what he's quoting or not. Parents, he's quoting me now. Parents don't literally own their children the way slave owners once owned slaves, but are rather their stewards and guardians, and ought to be held accountable by outsiders for their guardianship, which does imply that outsiders have a right to interfere. I stick by that. I think that's true. And I want to know, does he dissent from this statement? He presents it as if he disagrees. I'd like to know, does he actually dissent from this statement? So, what kind of facts would we teach in this curriculum? I'm just going to whirlwind tour of facts. What do you suppose this is? This is several million people on the banks of the Ganges River as seen from outer space, one of the largest congregations of human beings ever in history. Now, that's a really interesting phenomenon that cries out for an explanation. What on earth explains such an amazing congregation of bipeds? Well, it's, of course, this is a Hindu country, and the Hindu religions are older than Christianity, older even than Judaism, and they, unlike say Christianity, they don't have a sort of single founder. Their name for the highest god is Brahman, and everybody has a soul, an Atman, and if you perfect and purify your soul, that's nirvana, and you become one with Brahman. But in addition to Brahman, they have lots of gods. They have, for instance, Ganesh, the Indian god, and Lakshmi, the god of light. And they have avatars, which are gods come to earth, and they have names that are familiar to you, I'm sure, such as Krishna and Rama. And they have their holy texts, the Upanishads and the Vedas and so forth. And then you know also about the sacred cows. Even meat eaters in India, by and large, don't eat beef. They may eat other animals, but beef eating is pretty well out for the people in India. Except, I guess, for Christians, like the Christians in India. Now, then, moving along very quickly, here we have Islam. By the way, this is not a picture of Muhammad. As you know, they don't like to have pictures of Muhammad. That's Ali, his son-in-law. And it was the murder of Ali way back in 662, in the very early days of Islam, which led to the split, which we know today as the Sunnis and the Shias. Ali was the fourth caliph. As you know, Muslims are supposed to pray five times a day. They're forbidden to drink alcohol, and they hope to make a pilgrimage to Mecca, as you see in the pictures. Then we have the various brands of Christianity: Roman Catholicism and Russian Orthodoxy and Greek Orthodoxy and Protestant denominations by the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. And just for local color, I put on the top, on the right there, the mother church of the Church of Christ Scientists right here in Boston. And then down in the lower right-hand corner is the Mormon Tabernacle. And I'd certainly want students to learn about the Mormons, too, or the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. On the left, you see the angel Moroni, who Joseph Smith tells us came to him. Let me get the date right. I don't want to make a mistake. In 1823, on the 21st of September, the angel Moroni appeared to Joseph Smith, and then he came back 4 years later with what I'm reporting, of course, is Mormon doctrine, Mormon creeds. I'm not saying it's true. I'm just saying this is what Mormons believe. He brought with him these golden tablets on which were written Egyptian symbols of some kind, and with the aid of some magic stones, Joseph Smith was able to translate them, and that's where we get the Book of Mormon. So we'd certainly want people to know about that. And then here, more recent religion still, talk about Latter-day. This is just the 50th anniversary of the John Frum religion on the island of Tanna. This started after World War II. GIs on a neighboring island of Efate came in, they built an airstrip, they had all kinds of amazing cargo that the people on the island of Tanna had never seen, and they wanted some of that cargo, and so they decided that the GIs were sort of like gods, and they started a religion. They used the American flag, they dress up in sort of their idea of GI costumes, they carry bamboo imitation rifles, and they get into formations, and they're waiting for John Frum. John Frum? Who's John Frum? Well, there was nobody in the U.S. military named John Frum. It seems to be a corruption of John from America. And they're waiting for him to come down from the volcano with lots of cargo and wonderful gifts. And they've built an airstrip with a, sort of a bamboo flight tower and so forth. So there, you want people to know about that. Okay. Now, Do parents have the right to keep their children ignorant of facts like these about the world's religions? I don't think so. And I think just knowing all of these facts and a lot more that they would get, not in 5 minutes, but over, you know, little dribbles and dribbles in their curricula over their school years, this would be a good thing for everybody. I want to know if Dinesh thinks no, what is he afraid of? Is it the truth, maybe? These are just uncontroversial facts about the world's religions. I think everybody should know them. Now here's the Hagia Sophia in Istanbul. Here's some interesting facts about it. It started off as a church. Then it became a mosque, and now it's a museum. Isn't that interesting? Who knows what might happen next? It's hard to say. Here's the Vatican. Maybe in the life of your children or your grandchildren, it will become the European Museum of Roman Catholicism. Maybe Mecca will become Disney's Magic Kingdom of Allah. Who knows? The thing about religions is they're changing all the time. They are changing constantly. They've changed more in the last 200 years than they changed in the last 2,000 years. And they'll probably change in the next 20 years as much as they've changed in the last 200. And that's why it's important that everybody know about religions. So, and I don't know if Dinesh wants to disagree with this, but I think it's pretty clear that religions are human inventions. You've just seen quite a wonderful variety of odds and ends of religions. Those are human inventions. Now, they're not like the telephone, you know, not Alexander Graham Bell. It's more the way music or language are inventions. They're human productions, but they have an evolutionary history. Religions have evolved over thousands of years. In fact, there have been uncounted tens of thousands of religions that have sprung up over the last 2,000 or 3,000 years. Religions start up so fast that websites can't keep up with the new ones. Most of them have a half-life of a few weeks. A few last a generation or two. Some of them, only a few, you saw them on the initial list, last for even several thousand years. But not in their original form. They've evolved and evolved and evolved and evolved over that time. Here's Gustav Klimt's wonderful painting of the Tree of Life. And I thought I'd just pause. How am I doing for time? You have 10 minutes. Oh, good. To give a secular vision of how wonderful all of this is, and think about the Tree of Life. This is not a scientific diagram. This is an artistic diagram. Every plant, animal, bacterium, fish, bird, all of these things have evolved, descended from unicellular organisms that first appeared on this planet over 3 billion years ago. Not only the organisms, but the coral atolls and the beaver dams and the spider webs and the cities and the canals and the churches and the cathedrals and the forts and the bridges. All of these things are fruits on the Tree of Life. And over that period of time, they have become excellent, beautifully designed, sometimes with a lot of human intervention, sometimes not. They have all evolved, and it's all just wonderful. It is fantastic. I look around, and I am so glad to be alive. This world is so full of just plain wonderful stuff. And from a sunset to a musical performance. And I wish there was somebody to whom I could properly express my gratitude for all of this wonderful stuff. But there isn't. There's nobody the appropriate recipient of my thank you. So what I do instead is I just thank goodness. The very stuff that I'm just marveling at. There is all this goodness, and it's not just good bridges, good wings, good eyes, good tools. It's morally good systems of law. There is moral goodness in addition to engineering goodness, in addition to the goodness of a good baseball player or a good antelope. there is the goodness of human morality. And all of these things evolved. Where did it come from? It bubbled up from below. Now, this is a hard idea for a lot of people to understand. This is a page from a creationist pamphlet. I love this. I got this years ago. Do you know any builder that didn't have any building that didn't have a builder? Yes, no. Do you know of any painting that didn't have a painter? Yes, no. Do you know of any car that didn't have a maker? Yes, no. If you answered yes for any of the above, give details. Take that, you evolutionist, you. This piece of propaganda is wonderfully, it wears its heart on its sleeve. It finds the whole idea that there could be anything, any examples. It's just so laughable as to be a joke. And then along came Darwin, and he showed exactly that it wasn't a joke at all. Darwin's great idea was written about just a few years later by Robert Beverly McKenzie. And I love this quote, so bear with me. In the theory with which we have to deal, absolute ignorance is the artificer. So that we may enunciate as the fundamental principle of the whole system that in order to make a perfect and beautiful machine, it is not requisite to know how to make it. The caps are in the original. This proposition will be found on careful examination to express in condensed form the essential purport of the theory, and to express in a few words all Mr. Darwin's meaning, who by a strange inversion of reasoning, seems to think absolute ignorance fully qualified to take the place of absolute wisdom in the achievement of creative skill. Yeah, exactly right. And it is a strange inversion of reasoning. Some people just don't get it. They just can't get it. Many very distinguished thinkers just can't get it. Here's Paul Davies, a physicist, writing in 92. He says, the human mind can be no trivial detail, no minor byproduct of mindless, purposeless forces. Well, why would something that was a byproduct of mindless purposeless forces have to be trivial? Why couldn't it be important? It's because Davies unconsciously, I think, adheres to what I will call the trickle-down theory of goodness. Nothing can be good unless there's something much better on high that is its source. But there's just no reason to believe that. It makes sense of our past. We never saw a shoe make a cobbler. We never saw an arrow make a Fletcher. We're in Fletcher school. Fletchers were people that made arrows. So it looks like it always takes a big, fancy, wonderful thing to make a less thing. And some people just don't get it. One of the people who doesn't is Dinesh in his book. He just articulates the trickle-down theory as if it was just obvious. You just don't get the point. Now, finally, let's talk about God. It used to be people really did believe that God existed. And by God, they meant a very specific, concrete, identifiable type of God. Now, how many of you believe that Mount Everest exists? Good. How many of you can pick Mount Everest from these four pictures? I thought not. Yeah, we've got one or two people. Yeah. It's amazing. You can know that Mount Everest exists and not be able to pick it out. That's okay. So maybe something like that is going on with God. But in fact, I think what we see is an evolution of the concept of God. It starts off like Mount Everest. It's a really very grand and concrete. It's Yahweh, who's basically modeled on a warlord, a triumphant, militaristic, jealous, demanding leader. And then this is gradually turned into the ground of all being. What's that? Well, it's not an agent, doesn't have arms and legs, doesn't speak, doesn't listen. It's wonderful, but it has been pretty well, has shed most of its features. To the point where Peter DeVries, the novelist, wrote a novel where he had a character, an ultra-liberal minister, said, "It is the final proof of God's omnipotence that he need not exist in order to save us." That's the Reverend Mackerel in the Mackerel Plaza. So that's deliberate comedy, but sometimes truth is funnier than fiction. God is so great that the greatness precludes existence. That's from a book by Raimundo Panikkar, and it is deadly serious. So what we've seen is that the picture of God has gradually become more and more foggy. It's lost its detail. I'm going to close then with just one puzzling quote from Dinesh's book. He says, in that disparaging tone of his, that I fear the a toxic religious mania could end human civilization overnight. Well, I do. I mean, have you been paying attention to Pakistan and Iran? Actually, I'm more afraid that some self-righteous, factually challenged neocon in the Pentagon will decide that a nuclear strike might make some really good sense. So I want to know, don't you? Don't you fear this? Because I really do. Now, I'm going to end then with some questions for Dinesh. I really do want to know if he approves of my proposal for compulsory education on world religions. And if not, why not? And I want to know if he will apologize for misrepresenting it. And I want to know, does he fear that religious conviction might lead to a nuclear attack? And if not, why not? And I want to know if he agrees that John Frum, Ganesh, the angel Moroni, and the angel Gabriel are human inventions. And I also want to know, because he's not clear where he stands on evolution. Do you agree that our planet has had life for billions of years, that all life forms are descended from unicellular ancestors on the tree of life? Those are questions for Dinesh to answer. Thank you very much.
See, I have a wide podium here. I guess I didn't have to wear pants. I'm trying to decide in the time I have whether I should rebut Professor Bennett or Dennett or just jump into my own thoughts. I think what I'll do is touch on a couple of points that he makes and then come back in my rebuttal and address them more fully. First of all, let's begin with a couple of factual errors. Is religion growing? Globally, the answer is yes. In the West, the data is debatable. Europe, of course, is fairly secular. In America, we've certainly seen a resurgent atheism. But worldwide, there's really no debate. Professor Dennett really didn't cite any sources. I'll cite one, the historian Philip Jenkins, his book, The New Christendom. He points out that there is a rapidly growing religious revival throughout the world. I'm from India, and anyone who's from there will tell you that there is Hinduism resurgent in India, not in the number of nominal Hindus, but in the level of devotion. Christianity is spreading like wildfire in Asia and in Africa. In many African countries, the number of Christians 100 years ago was like 5%. Now it's about 50%. I don't know what you call that, but I call it growth. Look at South Korea, a continent that had virtually no Christians several decades ago. It now is over 50% Christian. You've got churches that have 100,000 members. There are tens of thousands of South Korean missionaries that are coming to Europe and some even to America. Many of the European cities, if you look at the pastors, they're from South Korea. So I just want to begin by saying that I'm happy to have a debate. Everyone is entitled to their own opinion, but everyone is not entitled to their own facts. Okay, now, to Professor Tadan's proposal about teaching religion. My objection is not so much to the proposal as to the sort of dripping elitist contempt in which it is couched. I mean, imagine if I were giving the same course that Professor Dennett gave you in miniature. I would give it very differently. I would say, all right, let's teach all the belief systems in the world, but let's include Dan's belief system, which is in a sense a kind of metaphysically grounded Darwinism. Let's also show the influence of that Darwinism in shaping social Darwinism, sterilization. Let's show the influence of Darwinism in the Nazi movement in Germany. Let's assign Richard Weikart's book From Darwin to Hitler, which shows, for example, that the Nazis were inspired really by two main currents, social Darwinism on the one side and Nietzschean atheism on the other. The combination of the will to power and survival of the fittest were essentially recruiting slogans for the Nazis. I would moreover say that instead of crying crocodile tears about the Inquisition, which occurred 500 years ago, and in which over the space of 350 years, some 2,000 people were killed, which apparently keeps Dan awake at night, let's focus a little bit more on the crimes of atheism, which didn't occur in ancient times. Let's not just focus on the Salem witch trials. We can pick up the tourist guide and realize that despite Arthur Miller's play, the number of people killed in the Salem witch trials was precisely 18. Now that is 18 too many, I'll grant you, but it doesn't even compare to what atheist regimes have done, again, not in ancient times, but in our own lifetime, in the last century. I'm not just talking about Mao in China or Stalin in Russia. I'm also talking about Pol Pot. Here's a guy in the space of 3 years who killed 2 million people. What about Ceausescu, Enver Hoxha, Fidel Castro, Kim Jong-il, atheist murders in the name of atheism are still going on. Now, Richard Dawkins, in his book, The God Delusion, says, oh yes, but the religious crimes were in the name of religion, but the crimes of atheism were not in the name of atheism. This is kind of what happens when you let a biologist out of the lab. Because here is a guy... Here is a guy who has apparently a zero comprehension of history. All you have to do is open up the Communist Manifesto. All you have to do is look at the atheist regimes, which said very explicitly, we want to create a new man and a new utopia freed from the shackles of traditional religion and traditional morality. So even bin Laden in his wildest dreams could not begin to rival the body count of atheist regimes, which begins not in the thousands or the tens of thousands, but in the millions and the tens of millions, an ocean of blood and a mountain of bodies produced by atheism in recent history. Now, so I think we should include all that in the course. I think it would be a valuable factual addition to what our children should learn. Now, what about this idea about, is God a man-made invention? Professor Dennett, Dan, says that there is not a single point in religious doctrine that has any factual basis whatsoever. I'm really not sure what he means by this. I assume the Ten Commandments, for example, would count as religious doctrine. I would grant you that the first three commandments are in the theological sphere or the sphere of revelation. I would suggest all the other items are points of doctrine that are completely within the orbit of reason. We can debate whether children should honor their parents or steal or covet your neighbor's wife. I know that there are some people in academia who think that may be a good idea, but most people around the world think that that's a pretty damaging way to organize a society. So morality might well have a universal basis, and in that sense is completely in the domain of fact. I'm not saying it's established fact. I mean, it can be debated in those terms. I want to turn, though, a little bit more deeply to this issue of the existence of God, because that's kind of what we're debating here, and I want to do it purely by appealing to the same reason and science and evidence that Dan has relied on in his opening statement. Now, for a couple of hundred years, it did appear that scientific evidence was cutting, you might say, against theism. We had Copernicus showing that the Earth is not the center of the universe. The Earth goes around the sun. We had Newton with his idea of the clockwork universe, the idea the universe is a kind of machine. It might require some divine jump-starting, but it doesn't require divine sustenance or intervention. Then we have Darwin's idea, which Dan has sort of been excited about, the idea that so we can have design, but no designer. But that was basically 150 years ago. I want to suggest that there have been startling recent developments in the last 100 years in physics, in astronomy, that strongly support theism, strongly support the idea of a creator, and are invulnerable to Darwinian attack. Let me begin the story sort of this way. About 1500 years ago, somebody posed a question to the church father Augustine, a very interesting question, which goes kind of this way. When you think of time, time goes back, but no matter how far back it goes, you can always think of it going further back. So if you say 5,000 years ago, someone could say 5,001 years ago. 1 million years ago, 1,001,000 years ago. It's kind of impossible to think of time as having any kind of a beginning. You can always retreat further into the past. And the question for Augustine was very simple. Could God have created the universe? And if he did, what was he doing before that? How did God occupy his time prior to creating a universe? And to this question, Augustine gave an astounding answer. He said, in effect, God created time along with the universe. In other words, before the universe, and we have to put the word before in quotation marks, there was no time. Once upon a time, there was no time. A kind of startling idea. Except that today, if you walk into an introductory physics course, you will learn that one of the direct implications of the Big Bang is that not only matter, but space and time had a beginning. In other words, one of the implications of the Big Bang is that not only did all the stuff of the universe, but space itself and time itself come into existence at a discrete point, what scientists call a singularity. This, I would suggest, is modern support. It's not a proof. We're not here debating proofs. We are debating evidence that would seem to suggest that all of nature, all of matter, came into existence at a given time. That, I would suggest, tends to corroborate something Augustine said with no evidence behind him. He claimed that, in effect, he got it from theology or he got it from revelation. My point is, Augustine didn't write to force agreement with science. Augustine stated a theological proposition, and modern science has come 1,500 years later to agree with him. Here's a second thought. In recent decades, scientists have asked the following question, and that is, why does the universe have the values that it does? Our universe has an incredibly wide and diverse set of very precise values. You can almost think, in fact, Lee Smolin, the physicist, whom Dan cites in his book, speaks about God as sitting, in a sense, at a big desk with 100 dials. And each dial reflects one of the values or forces of the universe. There is the mass of the electron, the mass of the proton, the gravitational force, the electromagnetic force, the electroweak force, and so on and so on. And the question is this. Why are those numbers set at precisely what they are? What if you were to move in and, let's say, fool with the dials a little bit, change them a little? What would happen? The scientists who asked this question came up with a very startling conclusion, and that is, if you touch the dials, if you fool with them, not to the point of 50% or 20% or even 1%, Stephen Hawking says in his Brief History of Time that if you touch one of the dials, this is the expansion rate of the universe, and move it one part in 100,000,000,000,000, we would have no universe. We would have no life. In other words, the constants and values of the universe appear to be fine-tuned precisely for, well, us. Now, my question to Dan Dennett. To me, the fine-tuned universe, which, by the way, has no Darwinian explanation. The Darwinian explanation has to do with how one life form became another. Well, I'm going to come back in my rebuttal and discuss what I think is Dan's promiscuous overextension of Darwin into areas that have nothing to do with evolution at all, to claim the prestige of science for very dubious theories about why humans laugh, why do they go to the toilet, and so on. We'll come to that later. What I want to say here is simply this. The laws of the universe are not established in a Darwinian way. And yet, what is the atheist explanation for how they came to be what they are? Why is the universe apparently fine-tuned for life? It would seem Occam's razor, the logic of simplicity, would seem to say a creator designed it that way. We may not know who built the car, or we may not know who did the painting, but is it even reasonable to suggest that the universe and all its laws created themselves? Let me put it a slightly different way. If we think of modern science has spent the last 500 years doing what? Excavating the intelligence built into the laws of nature. We live apparently in a rational universe that reflects extremely complicated laws, right? Kepler's laws of planetary motion, Newton's inverse square law, Einstein's E equals mc square, and so on. My question is, if our most brilliant scientists have spent their entire lifetime trying to decode the intelligence out of nature, who put it there? Or if not, a good question for Dan, how did it get there? Where did this intelligence come from? What is its explanation? What is your account for why nature obeys laws in the first place? You want to go to other cultures, you realize that this notion of a universe obeying laws is a Western and, in fact, to a large degree, a Christian idea. Other cultures deny it. The Muslim thinker Ghazali says it's absolutely ridiculous, the idea that nature follows laws. You and I can follow a law, but that's because we are intentional, purposeful human beings. We're driving on a road, we see a stop sign, we can follow a law. But can an electron follow a law? Can inanimate objects follow laws? It's preposterous. So Ghazali says the universe exists in the mind of Allah. Things happen because Allah intervenes every second to make them happen in exactly the way they happen. The reason I'm telling you this is I want to suggest that the premises of modern science themselves are based upon Christian metaphysics. The idea that the universe is rational. It obeys laws. These laws are accessible to our human minds. There is no Darwinian reason it must be so. Yes, we evolved, and I agree with Dan about this, but we evolved to survive, if you will, in hunter-gatherer primitive environments. We did not evolve to figure out the rotation of the planets. We did not necessarily evolve to figure out the theory of relativity. So evolution can tell us why we survive and why we adapt, but evolution can't tell us why we believe certain things to be true. Even Stephen Hawking admits this. There is no reason to believe that the stuff going on in your head is made up of atoms and molecules that interact with each other. Now, how do you know that that neuronal firing inside your head must match up and have a one-to-one correspondence with the rationality of the universe out there? Why must it be so? There is no reason. Now, if you're a Christian, you know why it's so. If you're a Christian, you say, I know why the universe is rational. It was created by an omniscient, super-rational God. I know why the universe obeys laws. God is both a physical and, you may say, a moral lawgiver. I know why our rationality can comprehend the universe out there. It's because we are created in God's image. We have a stamp of that divine rationality. So quite apart from our physical nature, formed, I agree, by evolution, we have a moral and a rational nature that allows us, one may say, to go beyond survival and understand truth. Truth that is more than sending my genes into the next generation. I've spoken a little bit about science. How am I on time? I've got 10 more minutes. Okay. I think I can do some more damage. I want to shift a little bit. I want to shift a little bit away from, I focused a little bit on nature. I want to talk a little bit more now about human nature. Because there is actually an argument for God that doesn't simply require us to contemplate the cosmos. In a sense, it is standing right in front of us. Or to put it somewhat differently, it can be seen by looking a little bit in the mirror. And that is, when we look at nature, let me clarify before I move on. I would agree with Dan that religion, by which I mean the various cultural human descriptions of God, are to a large degree man-made. After all, we are dealing with the sphere of experience, or we are dealing with a sphere of truth that lies beyond human experience. I think really, in some senses in this debate, both Dan and I are, in some senses, a specialized sense, we are both agnostics. And what I mean by that is we are debating a question for which there is not and cannot really be decisive empirical evidence. If I were to say to you, is there life after death? How could we figure this out? Dan might say, well, I don't see any evidence that it's so. Well, what kind of evidence are you waiting for? You want dead people to come back to life and stand up in court and give testimony? Is that what you're waiting for? Then you'll believe? No. All right. So Dan is exactly in the position of that caveman circa 5,000 BC or 10,000 BC, whose whole world was limited to 2 miles from where he was born, and decided on the basis of rational evidence that there could be nothing else out there. Why? Because his little instruments couldn't see them. In other words, how hubristic and narrow-minded of us to assume that all the available information we have now, that's it. That's all we know. And what we don't know can't possibly exist. It's ridiculous. It would have been absurd if we had believed that in the past. Imagine if other scientists had believed that 500 years ago. We deny the existence of all planets outside our solar system. Why? We've seen no evidence of them. This is Dan Dennett circa about 1450. All right. Here's the point I want to get at. We have nature, but we also have human nature. And that's us. And we know that although we are part of nature, we are made up of atoms and molecules, we are a little different than the rest of nature in one key respect. Take a stone rolling down a hill. A stone, quite frankly, has no choice in the matter. The stone rolls. It is a product of nature. We, on the other hand, seem to exist in two dimensions. We are products of nature, but we are also products ultimately of free will, of choice, of intentionality, of feelings, of consciousness, of morality. Now I ask you, where can those things be found under the microscope? Have you ever seen consciousness? No, Dan Dennett argues, because he can't see it, it doesn't exist. It's kind of an illusion. It's ultimately a sort of projection or epiphenomenon of material things. Everything has to be reduced to the material. Why? Because ultimately our great wide universe has to be truncated in a Procrustean way to make it fit with materialist morality. Half of our experience, the entire subjective dimension, has to be canceled out. So for Dan, if a computer can process a transaction and you can process a transaction, hey, the computer is being rational. The computer is human in some fundamental sense, no different from you. And why? Because the result is the same. Now, I think this is a bit of foolishness that it really perhaps takes a non-academic to see. In other words, we have knowledge of nature not just from the outside. We are like stones, but we also have choice. Here I am participating in this debate, and our debate is based on free exchange of ideas and free will. I mean, I could put this microphone down and go sit down. Is the firing of my neurons in my head determining my decision? Is it telling me one way or the other? No, I can go either way. I speak, I stop. So the dimension of free will would seem to suggest that there is a part of us that one may say can override the laws of nature. Now, in what way? Obviously, if I throw this microphone, its trajectory, its parabola-like motion, it will fall to the ground in obedience to the laws of gravity. I admit all that. But my decision to throw it, I would suggest, is undetermined. And why? Think about it. Imagine if all our actions were determined. If that were true, there would be no point in having this debate. There would be no point in us having universities. There would be no point in having morality, because you could never just say to someone, you shouldn't do this, you mustn't do that, this isn't right, because they would answer, what choice do I have in the matter? You can't go to Hitler or the Nazis and say, you shouldn't wipe out an entire population, because they would say, well, my neurons made me do it. Ultimately, I want to suggest that this materialist morality, and Dan is about as clever as anyone in camouflaging it, disguising it, trying to show that ultimately he does believe in consciousness, even though he defines it differently. He does believe in free will, even though he defines it differently. Everything is ultimately defined differently. And why? To fit in with this narrow materialist morality. And this brings me really to a key question. Why would anyone be attracted to a metaphysics that ultimately denies, if you will, half of our humanity, the whole subjective dimension, the whole moral dimension? I want to suggest ultimately that atheism is not even so much an intellectual revolt. Because think about it, when it comes to God, I would agree, I don't know that God exists. I believe that he does. Now, knowledge is not the same thing as belief. I wouldn't say I believe in my brother. I know the guy. You only believe when you don't know. So here's the difference. I don't know, and still I believe. Dan doesn't know, and therefore he doesn't believe. What unites us is both of us don't know. We're actually both ignorant. The only difference is Dan thinks he's a champion of reason, and I'm a champion of blind faith. No, we are both reasoning in the dark. The only difference is he won't admit it. I am saying that ultimately the decision to embrace God is not even just a matter of reason. It's ultimately also a matter of choice. And why? The reason was given by Pascal. He said a long time ago that there are some things in life for which you'll never have the evidence. You've dated a woman. You've gone out with her for 5 years, 10 years. I submit that there's no amount of dating that can convince you what life with her will be like for the next 50 years. There's no way to know. So you could say, well, you know what? I'm going to be an agnostic. I'm going to wait for the data to come in. Well, if you're an agnostic in that sense, she will marry someone else, or you will both be dead. You ultimately have to decide based on what you know, whether you should propose, whether you should go for it. You've got to ultimately make that rational step. So faith is involved. But I'm suggesting that from the outset, it is a rational faith grounded in science, grounded in evidence, grounded in experience, and ultimately asking, what kind of society do we want to be part of? Is there a reason to believe in a transcendent basis for the world? How did it come to be? For us, why are we here? At the end of the day, this is a matter of what Pascal called the wager. And by the wager, what he meant was, you can bet on God. And he said, if you're wrong, what's going to happen? Well, you've made a metaphysical mistake. On the other hand, you can bet against God. And if you're wrong, alas, you will be separated from God. Not by his choice, by the way, by yours. You are cutting yourself off from God. And Pascal's point is, why would any rational person choose against God? If you choose against him, you lose nothing. If you choose for him, you have the prospect of gaining everything. And so the idea here is to humbly open yourself up to God. Of course, do it on the basis of evidence, not against the evidence. But the idea is that if you do, ultimately, you might come to see that God is a human creation, but we humans are a divine creation, are the product not only of divine intelligence, but to some degree also of divine love. Thank you very much.
Humility is a Christian virtue. And one of the things that you might want to be humble about is your own understanding of the doctrines that you're criticizing. You have had great fun with what I would consider cartoon versions of just about all the... is this on? Hello. Now is it on? And it wasn't. Okay. Sometimes the way people understand things is by rewriting them in their own terms and then saying, oh, well, what a crazy idea that is. And of course, if they haven't done justice to them in their own terms, then it's pretty crazy. So what we've seen here, I think, is a number of occasions in which... try another microphone. Where the microphone? Yeah, that's better. We've seen a number of caricatures lambasted, a lot of fun had with them. I don't know which ones to start with. Well, let's talk about the Big Bang. For Dinesh, this is proof of God's existence. Remarkable how a creator comes into this picture. I don't see that space and time in our universe started, 14 billion years ago? Yeah, that's right. But not that God created space and time, that the universe, by having the Big Bang, created space and time. Now, if you say, well, the universe can't create itself, well, God can't create itself either. I don't know where you get the other principle that there has to be a creator, unless you're just falling back on the trickle-down theory of goodness again, right? You just don't see how something this wonderful could exist unless there was something more wonderful still that created it. That's the pre-Darwinian hunch, and I think there's it's just a hunch, and you have nothing going there. How did the universe get here? No, that was the question he had. It's the other way around. How did we get here in this part of the universe? Well, we couldn't be in a part of the universe that had other laws, and as far as we know, there may be lots of other universes in which wondering creatures like us couldn't exist. And so the fact that we exist in a wonderfully fine-tuned universe is nothing that requires the explanation of a brilliant creator. We couldn't exist in any other universe. Here we are. This is simply a cartoon version of the anthropic principle. And there's a lot of literature out there. I'm not going to try to give a physics lecture here. Neither you nor I are physicists or cosmologists. If Alex Vilenkin were here, I'm sure he would be willing to fill in that detail. More important to me, I think, is... let's see. All of these different points. Well, let's go back to your opening numbers of atheist murders. Yes, the number of people killed by atheists in the 20th century is terrible. But first of all, notice that the regimes that you're talking about were themselves sort of proto-religions. In fact, it occurred to me, let's think about Stalin for a moment. Was he an atheist? You might say, well, of course he was an atheist. No, on the contrary, I think in a certain sense, he wasn't an atheist at all. He believed in God. Not only that, he believed in a God whose will determined what right and wrong was. And he was sure of the existence of this God, and the God's name was Stalin. And he created a cult of worship and of refusal to tolerate any disagreement. And this is the way. This is, in fact, the way religions used to start in the old days. If we look at Kim Il-sung in North Korea, I think we see a good case of that, too. Oh my, there's so many points to talk about. You say, as if it were just obvious, that free will, choice, consciousness, intentionality, that there's no explanation of those in terms of the Darwinian picture. Well, of course, you might be right, But my whole career has been designed to elaborate those explanations, and I seem to have made a fair amount of progress. I can't, of course, hope to show you those complexities in a minute or in 5 minutes or in an hour, but for you just to assert that, of course, these things can't be explained in this way, strikes me as simply an assertion that you pull out of thin air.
Well, in your book, Breaking the Spell, Dan makes, I think, a very useful, you may say, rule of fairness. He's talking about atheism, he's talking about religion, and he basically says this. He says, every time somebody accuses a religious dictator of doing something bad, all the Christians basically say, oh, but it wasn't me, it wasn't Christ, he didn't teach that, and so on. To which Dan has the following answer, which I think is worth taking seriously. He says, wait a minute. He goes, religion has got to take responsibility for the crimes committed in its name. I cite this in my book. He says, if someone kills in the name of Allah, Islam's going to have to take a bit of responsibility for that. If Hamas or Hezbollah does it, you can't just say, well, they weren't being true Muslims. They think they were. And I agree with Dan's principle. But then I notice that when it comes to atheism, he tries to dodge it. Because if it is true that the ordinary mild-mannered Christian has got to take some responsibility, even for the Salem witch trials, even for the Inquisition, even for the Crusades, then I maintain that the ordinary mild-mannered atheist at the Tufts Free Thought Society has to take some responsibility for Pol Pot and for Stalin. These guys were committing their crimes in the name of, you can't just say, well, they sort of resembled religion. Now you're basically saying religion must take the blame not only for what's done in its name, but also for what's done in the name of atheism. This is a totally bogus form of reasoning. So, let me turn. So, if the Christians have to take responsibility for Torquemada, poor Dan's going to have to take some responsibility for Stalin. That's just the way it is, based on his principle. Now, let's talk about the Big Bang, very briefly. I don't want to get into a debate about physics. I just want to say something very simple. All of nature came into existence at a certain singularity. Before that, one may say there was no nature, so there can't be a natural explanation for the Big Bang, because the Big Bang encompasses all of nature. So here's my argument. It's very simple. Everything that has a beginning has a cause. The universe has a beginning. The universe has a cause. That cause we call God. That's my argument. Now, fine-tuning. Here is where we get into what I want to call faith-based atheism. Because we have the fact of a universe. And by the way, Dan, I think, very cunningly tried to shift the argument, which is not an argument I made. I did not say that out of the millions of stars in our universe, it's very surprising that we have life on Earth. That can be easily explained. I never made that argument. My argument is that the entire universe with all its galaxies and all its stars has to be exactly as old as it is. The mass of the proton has got to be 1900 or 1836 times the mass of the electron and slightly less heavy than the neutron. My point is the gravitational force, not just here, everywhere, has to be what it is for the universe and life to exist. That's the argument, so answer that one. Well, Dan backed up and tried to answer. He goes, well, maybe, and this is a really big maybe, there are lots of other universes. And in fact, there are some cosmologists who say, well, maybe there are an infinite number of universes. And if there are an infinite number of universes, then our universe, however improbable, would in fact, at some point in the great cosmic rolling of the dice, at some point come up. This is what I would call, you may say in some version, the OJ cosmological argument. The DNA evidence points to me, all the other evidence points to me, but that's only in this universe. Maybe there are many other universes in which you, individual jurors, have killed your wives under new DNA evidence and under new laws. So why would you prosecute me in this provincial universe just because I did what I did in this local planet? Now look, I'm not saying that this is even untrue. I don't even mean to be making fun of it. What I'm really saying is it takes a lot of faith to believe it. Because what is the evidence for these other universes? Dan, in his book, actually cites this man, Lee Smolin, and his astronomical work. I just want to read you a line or two from Smolin. He says, what I'm presenting in this book is frank speculation, if you will, a fantasy. And then, later in the book, I must warn the reader that the ideas I've been describing, there is every chance they will not succeed. He admits in the book very easily, he is essentially engaging, he doesn't like the idea of God. He says that the fine-tuning of the universe seems to point to a supernatural creator, but we can't possibly go there because we're scientists and we have to look for a natural explanation. So he goes, this is the best stuff I can come up with. Now, okay, fair enough, but how about some humility on the other side? How about admitting that there is a lot about our universe that does seem to suggest that just as a car requires a car maker, and just as a painting requires a painter, the laws of nature do require some ultimate explanation. And that's all I'm saying. It opens up the possibility of a divine explanation. Thank you.
Okay, well, let's, here we go. The laws of nature require explanation. Well, at any one point, we explain the laws we've got maybe with some other laws, and so it goes. And at any one point, we have laws that we can't explain. That's certainly true. And by the way, the sort of caricature of laws as if they were the kind of laws that, you know, there's penalties for violating. That's not what scientists have ever meant by laws of nature. And anybody who thinks that that's a legitimate criticism is simply misunderstood the nature of the sort of generalization that a physical law is supposed to be. Smolin present some speculations. He says, here's one thing it could be. I cite them as speculations and say, here's an idea. I don't endorse it. I say, here's an interesting set of scientific ideas. It's nice because it's actually testable. And there are others. There's actually an embarrassment of riches. There's lots of ideas for what it could possibly be that could explain the fine-tuning, that could possibly explain the fine-tuning of this universe. That's all the cosmologists and all the physicists are doing at this point, is responding to what otherwise looks very appealing, and that is, what could it possibly be but an intelligent creator? The answer is, oh, there's lots of things it could possibly be but an intelligent creator. So we'll just call that a draw, maybe. Maybe this is where your agnosticism can join mine, and we say, we really don't know what could or would explain the laws of nature, but we don't need to invoke an intelligent creator to explain it. And in fact, the trouble with an intelligent creator is that it seems to get the wrong end of the stick, because we need to explain, where did that intelligent creator come from? Isn't that even more marvelous than the fact that there might be even an infinity of universes, all with slightly different generalizations in them? That idea seems to me at least less extravagant than the idea of a self-creating, eternal, omnipotent, intelligent creator. Let's see. I'll say a bit more about Stalin and atheism then. Yes, I think that we all have to recognize that any powerful idea can be misused, can be abused, and can lead to great harm. And I'm sure that some atheists have made the mistake of what we might call Dostoevsky's mistake, and that is, if God is dead, everything is permitted. Now, that does not follow at all. That is a myth that has done a tremendous amount of damage in the world. And any atheists who think that an implication of their atheism is that there's no difference between right and wrong, that there's no room for morality, I think has made a very serious mistake. It's a mistake which is very easily made because so many religious people insist on this principle as well. They seem to think that without God, there can't be any goodness, there can't be any morality. This is belied, I think, by everything we know. And notice, finally, that even if it were true that we needed God to tell us what's right and wrong, God doesn't tell us. Only God's self-appointed representatives on earth tell us. So in other words, we're going to have to tell each other anyway. Human beings can figure out what is reasonable, what is rational, and what is moral. Human society has evolved to the point where we can sit down and reason, and of our own free will, arrive at the best principles to govern our lives by our own lights after open, free, reasonable discussion, fact-based discussion. That's the basis of morality. It's always been the basis of morality. If you look at the morality in the Old Testament, compare it to the morality today, you find that it has changed a great deal, and it has changed because people's ideas about what makes sense, what's right and wrong, have evolved. They've grown up. And it's not because God told them something different today than told them before. It's they just figured out that they could no longer tolerate the interpretations of what God was supposedly telling them morality was that used to pass muster. So we're stuck telling each other as best we can how to live our lives and what makes sense morally. And if it helps you to adorn that process with an imagined deity that speaks to you, that's a psychological fact about you, but it plays no role in the discussion.
I've been trying to listen hard in this debate because I don't want this to be a mudslinging cartoon debate, but one in which we really try to engage issues. And so rather than rebut, I'm going to try to seriously engage some points that have been raised here. I agree, by the way, that morality is not in any way the special province of religious people. I completely agree with that. I think morality is a universal phenomenon. But I think it is a universal phenomenon that cannot be given the easy explanation that Dan gives. We evolved. Wait a minute. Does any biologist believe that we have in a serious way evolved over the last 5,000 years? No. Biologically, we have not evolved. Culturally, morally, socially, institutionally, we're different. Biologically, we're very much the same as Homo sapiens was 5,000. So the word evolution now has been transmuted from a biological meaning, and it's been put on a moral high horse. I want to suggest something different. No, human beings are not in some fundamental, natural way better now. In fact, our weapons of mass destruction in some ways have given us a vehicle to be far worse. Yes, it is true that we have representative democracy, and we have the abolition of slavery, and we have the equal dignity of women, and we have the compassion as a social virtue. And you know why we have those things? Not because human beings have evolved. It's because you're living in a Western civilization shaped primarily by Christian assumptions. How do you know this? Look at an example. If there's a famine tomorrow in Rwanda, you can be fairly sure that all the European countries will rush to help, send bags of food, send volunteers, Doctors Without Borders, and so on. Now, there are other rich countries in the world. They will observe, but do nothing. And why? Because they were raised with the belief I was kind of raised with as a kid, which is an Indian proverb, the tears of strangers are mostly water. which is to say, to some degree, you look out for your own, by the way, a sound Darwinian principle, but you don't necessarily have any common ground with strangers who don't share anything with you. So the point here is, even the European countries that are secular will act in a Christian way. And why? For the reason given by Nietzsche. You can kill God, but you still, at least for a time, have a Christian civilization formed on Christian assumptions. It was those same assumptions that produced the only anti-slavery movement the world has ever known. It was the Quakers and the evangelical Christians who said we are created equal in the eyes of God, and therefore no man has the right to rule another without consent. All right. I want to now say a word about, well, just a word about toxic religion. Because that was really the main thrust of Dan's opening presentation. We need to have this education because young people need to learn about toxic religion. And all I'm trying to argue, and I haven't seen it really contested, is that religion is greatly blamed for things, even today, that have very little to do with religion. Oh, but what about the Israelis and the Palestinians? Oh, what about the Shia and the Sunni? What about Northern Ireland? What about in the Balkans? What about the Hindus and the Muslims in Kashmir? Okay, what about those people? Why are the Israelis and the Palestinians fighting? Are they fighting about religion? Are the Israelis saying Moses was a greater prophet? And the Palestinians, no, no, it was Muhammad who was the greater prophet. No, they are fighting over land. Why are the Hindus and Muslims fighting? They are fighting over Kashmir. In Northern Ireland, they were not fighting about transubstantiation or the Eucharist. They're fighting over which group gets to rule that country. They're fighting about self-determination. So I'm suggesting that one of the problems in this debate, I'm not saying that Dan is incompetent in his field, he's extremely competent, but I'm saying that in this new atheism, we have all these guys from Dawkins to Dan to others who are wandering far outside their fields where they know very little and making authoritative pronouncements about theology, about history, about Christianity. Christopher Hitchens in about three lines disposes of Anselm. Sam Harris, biology major, takes on Aquinas in a paragraph. I mean, this is intellectually embarrassing. And I think what it reflects is ultimately an atheist bigotry that is really not willing to take religion seriously. So my goal in this debate has not been ultimately to make the proof for the existence. I said I'm not proving anything. But I am saying that I want to suggest to you that there are serious arguments deriving from history, philosophy, and science that make the case that we should take seriously what most people from most of human history have taken seriously, and even now. So ultimately, this provincial, you may say, northeastern atheism of the academy that snickers at the whole world as being a bunch of idiots, I mean, is this the kind of elitism you want to have in the university where you don't take seriously the way other people experience the world? I mean, consider religion. Let me give you an analogy and I'll close on that. Let's say, for example, I was accused of a crime. I'm accused of killing somebody. I know I didn't do it. I come into court and Dan produces five pieces of evidence that say, here is the external evidence that you did it. Now, am I supposed to agree with that evidence, even though I know I didn't do it? In other words, my inward experience is of innocence. The external evidence as laid out is in front of me. All I'm saying is religious people experience the world and experience God as very real in their lives. It's no answer to them to say, well, we can find a guy who saw a UFO. Well, you produce 2/3 of people on the planet who see UFOs on a daily basis since the beginning of time, and I'll take those people seriously. So I'm suggesting that academically, we shouldn't think ourselves superior to everyone else. If you approached any other subject like race relations, imagine if I started making jokes and producing little quips about slaves with funny names and so on, you'd be appalled. And if I said that should be required teaching in the curriculum, after all, people have had very interesting attitudes toward race relations over the centuries. This is not intellectually serious. So To answer Dan's question, I agree with the spirit of his proposal. I just don't want him to be the guy doing it. Thank you.
Well, we will begin our question and answer session. Is there an extra mic for the members of the audience? The other one was intended for that. Those of you who have questions for either or both of our debaters, please come up to one of the aisles and a microphone will be made available. And once again, please ask a question and make it brief. Thank you.
Oh,
yes.
Hi. I would like to ask Dinesh a question about Occam's razor. You mentioned that the Darwinian concept of Occam's razor is less simpler than the creator and creator argument. But isn't that kind of a circular argument? What if there was a creator? Then who created the creator, and who created the creator that created the creator, and so on and so forth?
The question is about if we have a creation and we can posit a creator, who made that guy? And that's a good question. I want to answer it this way. I want to begin with a short analogy, if I may. Think of the universe as a novel. In other words, think of the universe as structured in terms of plot, narrative, characters, and so on. I want to suggest that what religious people are saying is that this novel doesn't explain itself. The novel had an author, a creator. Now, the creator is the creator of the novel at a little bit of a different level of causation than the causation within the novel. So, for example, if you're reading Crime and Punishment, you may say, oh, this guy Raskolnikov, he did this. Well, why did he do that? What accounts for him? That's a sensible question. It would be like asking, what's causing, for example, gravity, or what's causing planets to come together? These are questions of causation within the universe. Now, I want to suggest that Dostoevsky is the creator of the novel at a different level. So the questions that apply to the within the causation of the novel don't apply to the external cause of it. You can't say, well, this guy Dostoevsky, what explains him? Where does he come from? He's not internal to the narrative. That's the point I'm trying to get. So if all of nature had a beginning, it has to have a non-natural, and that is all that religious people mean by the word supernatural, cause. Now, that supernatural cause doesn't apply the laws of physics, and why? Because scientists will tell you that the laws of physics are internal to our universe. Just as language requires grammar, and you can't have language, you can't have grammar without language, right? Grammar is the rules for how language internally interacts. The laws of physics are the rules for how our universe interacts. So the laws of physics, I'm just finishing my point, don't apply, you may say, outside of the singularity. If God created the universe, and I'll put an if before it, he didn't use any of the existing laws of physics to do it. That's my point.
To follow up on that.
Dinesh, the trouble with that argument is that you basically contradict yourself. You say... You use the word created, which is, in effect, a word from the novel, and you claim to give it meaning. Well, if it doesn't mean what it means in the novel, then we don't know what it means. And so your insistence that, well, look, if it has a beginning, something has to create it. That's, you're helping yourself to the regularities within the world within the natural world, and then you're saying, oh, but they don't apply outside the natural world. Well, if they don't apply outside the natural world, then you have no right to talk about creation at all, because that's something that we know of from the natural world.
Forgive me if I don't articulate this very clearly, but as far as I understand it, Pascal's wager is basically you're betting on if you don't believe in God, then you know you might be screwing yourself over in the afterlife, because then you'll be divided from him. And the thing I take issue with, or that I find kind of makes the whole argument fallacious, is it doesn't allow for the possibility that a non-believer could in fact be intimate with the divine in the afterlife. It assumes the kind of Abrahamic premise that disbelief is in some fashion offensive to the divine and therefore divides you from him or it in the afterlife. And basically what I'm saying is, if we then say, okay, it is possible that a non-believer could find intimacy with the divine in the afterlife, then Pascal's wager is reduced to, well, it's still a really good bet because a lot of people believe in these kind of Judeo-Christian idea of reward and punishment based on faith. But then where do you draw the line? Because then I could come up with a rule today that said I feel really strongly that if you don't do 10 push-ups a day, you're going to hell. And it's a good bet because if you go ahead and do the 10 push-ups, then you're all set. But if you don't do them, you're risking going to hell. So I'm just saying, where do you draw the line in terms of absurdity? I mean, is it a more valid risk because so many people believe in this reward punishment scheme?
Well, I think the power of Pascal's wager is the following, and that is that two things. One is it exposes the great weakness of the agnostic position. Because the agnostic usually fashions himself or herself a morally superior person who stays in this sort of suspended doubt awaiting evidence. And what Pascal is saying is that, listen, no, this is not a reasonable position, not only, by the way, because of the afterlife, but because the afterlife makes a lot of difference in how you live now. I mean, imagine if someone were to say to you, instead of living for 80 years, you're going to live for 500 years. You probably would live somewhat differently. Or like the recent movie with Queen Latifah, where you you have only 7 more days to live. You would live differently. We would all live differently if we believed in eternal life. So the point that Pascal is making is you have to take the idea seriously, not just for then, but also for now. It's going to affect how you live now. Okay? So agnosticism becomes a sort of willful refusal to take a stance when it makes a lot of difference what you decide. See, one of the problems with saying I'll only stick with scientific issues and only go with the scientific evidence is that science, while sovereign in its own sphere, doesn't affect large spheres of life, including love, including consciousness, including will. I'm not saying science has nothing to say about it, but just read Steven Pinker's How the Mind Works. Science hasn't gotten very far in explaining sentience, morality. Not that the evolutionists haven't tried. They've tried really hard. And I'll say a word later maybe about evolution and morality. But what Pascal is basically saying is, in much of life, many of the decisions you make, you graduate from Tufts, you have a choice, do I become a poet or I go to law school? That choice may affect everything that subsequently happens to you. It may affect who you marry, where you go to graduate school, or whether you go at all, whether you end up in politics or a partner in a law firm. And you have no information. You can never get full information, and yet you have to choose. And the same is true of God as well. That's the argument.
Yeah, I'm sorry for reading this, but I tried to put this all together, and it's too bizarre to remember. So I believe this is for Dr. D'Souza. I believe you call yourself a Christian, and so for the sake of argument, let's accept your argument that there is a creator of the universe, and that creator is omniscient. What would make you go from that to that he's like also a loving God and he created us in his perfect image, but then we turned out to be imperfect, so he decided to cast us down to burn hell, but then he didn't feel so good about that, so the only loophole he could come up with, the creator of the universe, was to immaculately conceive a human child and have him tortured and killed, and we're still imperfect, but that's okay if we suck up to him and the child, and he doesn't want us to be gay, and so on.
Okay, let me try to answer in the spirit. And that's this. Look, if you are trying to understand a phenomenon, whether you agree with it or not, you begin by understanding it, by trying to understand it as the believer or the practitioner understands it themselves. If I was trying to understand Dostoevsky or take Hamlet, I wouldn't go, well, this is absolutely ridiculous. Witches appearing and so on, it's absurd. I'd throw the novel down right away. I'm not going to read it. It's absurd. No, I imagine, I suspend my disbelief. I say, let me try to experience Hamlet in the way Shakespeare wanted it experienced. And then once I've finished, once I've evaluated critically, I can step back and go, well, that didn't make much sense, and that didn't really follow from that, and why is Hamlet so indecisive, and so on. Okay, here's what I want to get at. Let me give you, if I may, in 1 minute, the Christian reformulation of your statement of the human problem. The Christian formulation is this, and that is, quite apart from religion, we have a human problem. Namely, we live at two levels. We live here, and we want to be here. In other words, we want to be good, but we realize we fall short. We want to experience the divine, but God is invisible. He's not real to us on a daily basis. We feel the awful silence, you may say, speak from outside. So here we are as human beings. We're at this level. We want to ultimately experience the sublime. True? I think all human beings are that way. And that's why we have not just religion, we have art, we have literature, we have love, ways of experiencing the sublime. Now, the different religions of the world all diagnose the human problem that way. And I see the Eastern religions as having one solution. The problem is the self. Get rid of the self. I see the Judaism and Islam as having a common solution, which is basically, let's establish a set of rules and codes to bridge the gap between, you may say, man down here and God up here. And this involves dietary regulations and sacrifices and commandments and so on. And Christianity comes along and gives a totally different answer to that question. Namely, look, the distance between the humans and the divine is so large that no matter how tall a ladder you build, you're not going to get there. Basically, the only way for man to reach God is for God to come down to man's level. And I'm stating this in very secular terms. So the incarnation is seen not as just some bloody sacrifice. I mean, most Christians would emphasize not the crucifixion, but the resurrection. The idea here is that in the ancient world, you had a lot of blood. Look at all the blood the Aztecs spilled. Look at all the blood sacrifices in the ancient world. Basically, Christianity comes along, and the basic argument is God sacrifices his son, and that's the end of all the blood sacrifice. No more need to kill goats. No more need to take people and slap them on the altars and chop their heads off. And this was widespread in the ancient world in pagan cultures. And these blood sacrifices, I would argue, have been revived in modern paganism and modern atheism. This idea that blood itself is a source of power. Just read the rhetoric of the Nazis. There's a lot of talk about blood. Volk, blood. This idea of purifying blood is a revival of ancient animism, and I would argue ancient paganism, but given a secular guise. I mean, Hitler, for example, spent a lot of time talking about the Nordic legends, a lot of time talking about the ancient gods. The only difference was he didn't believe in them. He was trying to give them a secular reinterpretation. All right, I'm going on and on. But what I'm getting at here is simply that the Christian experience is very different than your, I think, caricature of it. So if we're going to get away from cartoon belief, I'd like to see my belief. I don't mind having them criticized, but I'd like to see them criticized in the way that I articulate them and defend them. Thank you,
Dennis. Well, is there a question for Professor Dennis?
Thank you. I sort of have what is sort of, I think, a logical... Is it on? Okay. I sort of have what I would think is a logical follow-up to the last question. And my question is tying it also to the idea of Pascal's wager. So Pascal's wager, as I see it, as you've proposed it, is predicated on the idea that there are two options. There's closeness to God and there are disbelief and belief. My question, though, is when you have Christians who tell me that the only way to heaven is through belief in Jesus Christ, and you have Muslims telling me that the only way is through a set of beliefs in Muhammad, and Jews or Buddhists or any other belief telling me their belief is the only valid belief structure, don't you have to at least reevaluate Pascal's wager to the point where the logical option is at least agnosticism and at most atheism?
Yeah. I put the point even more strongly. If we're talking about rationality, why don't you bet on all of them at once? If it's really, if one wager is good, well, go for all of them, and that way you got all your bases covered.
Well, that's not rational, because these religions do make some mutually exclusive claims. But I would say quite seriously that if you're taking your point seriously, and following it, the conclusion is not. I mean, look, let's look by analogy. We conduct a survey of all the world's cultures, okay, tomorrow, and I ask them only scientific questions. What do you think about Kepler's laws? What do you think about evolution? What do you think about Einstein? I submit to you, we will get a wide range of answers. Many people may say, well, you know, I've listened to the arguments, I'm going to go with Ptolemy on that one. Well, I've listened to all this, I think old Einstein was basically joking. So you might get the vast majority of the world's people go thumbs down on Darwin, thumbs down on Einstein. But you don't go from that, well, you know what? The disagreement of all these different cultures clearly convinces me that there's no true answer. I will be an atheist and agnostic on these issues from now on. You would see that as a total non sequitur. Why? Because you believe that there is a right answer and it's your job to find out what it is. So if you follow your premise seriously, yes, the religions of the world have certain common elements, common morality. Many of them today, at least, posit a monotheistic creator. And I would say it's your job to go find out which one is making true claims. Spend some time and take it seriously, and then decide what you think is the right way to go. I'm not asking you to go any other way than what you think is right, but to just in a facile way go, there's 10 of them, and they can't all be right, so I'll choose none of the above. That's not a very rational solution.
Another question for you. I'm sorry that all the questions are going to you. Personally, I'm a little bit worried by almost the ease of God as a response. God is almost defined, or God is generally defined as outside the human sphere of consciousness. God is invisible. God is not in one particular place. If we searched the entire universe, we could not possibly find God. I feel like this definition of God as completely outside the human realm of testing is a simplification, or not a simplification, but too easy of an answer.
Well, do you mind if I ask you a question or two in response? Okay. You experience an external world, right?
Yes.
But the external world you experience is experienced through the lenses of your five senses.
Yes.
Can you give me an independent proof that the rest of us could accept that your experience of the external world actually corresponds with the external world out there? Can you prove that?
I probably could not.
Okay. You know, you accept the existence of other people, other minds, other souls, other people out there, right? You believe that there are other people in the world. You're not the only guy on Earth, right?
Right.
Okay. Do you think you can give independent demonstration that doesn't rely on your own subjective consciousness at all, since we can't see that other minds actually exist?
I think it's going to depend on my subjective consciousness.
Exactly. All right. So there are large spheres of human experience, consciousness, love, morality, that rely on the subjective dimension of human experience that can never be produced under a microscope and under a telescope, and yet you couldn't live 1 second or 1 day without them. Your whole, in fact, far from matter creating mind, isn't it true that the entire experience, our entire experience of the world, comes through our consciousness, which is an irreducible starting point of all experience. Without that consciousness, we have no window into external reality at all. True?
True.
Okay. And yet, all of that you take for granted as having an independent existence. You go through life perfectly willing to accept consciousness, reality, other people. But somehow, when it comes to God, your standards change completely. Suddenly you go, oh gee, I've sent people into outer space. I haven't seen any big man with a beard out there handing out stuff. So how can I really believe in that guy? That's all I'm saying to think about.
I think the slip in what you just said is in saying that consciousness is irreducible. Consciousness is where each one of us starts, of course, with our own experience. But then, thanks to our developed scientific worldview, we can pool the experiences of others. Of course, we need our own experience to do that. And then we can turn that tool back on ourselves, and we can study our own subjectivity. We can study our own consciousness. We can have theories of human consciousness. We can understand what makes us tick. And there's nothing irreducible about it. We are on the, of all things to say, at this point in the 21st century, when we are making such tremendous progress in understanding the machinery, if you like, of consciousness, that strikes me as just preposterous.
Yeah, okay. My question is about intelligent design and evolution. Where do you stand, each of you, on the issue? Was God a product of intelligent design, or did he evolve?
Was God a product of intelligent design? No,
I think he was.
Okay. Well, I think some concepts of God are a product of human design. I think that is some conceptions of God are very clearly contrived by individual human contrivers. Some religions, I mean, Scientology is a religion. It's entirely the result of human deliberate design. Whereas other religions, like Christianity, say, in more generally, is itself a product not of intelligent design, but of evolved design, culturally evolved design, where most of the design moves, most of the R&D was unwittingly done by humans passing on their traditions in the same way that languages are unwittingly designed. So I think that the concept of God is indeed a product of that sort of process, in the same way that the harmonic scale is a product of that sort of process. As far as the intelligent design movement in America, that's just a hoax.
Next question. Yeah.
Well, let's put it this way. Einstein's laws are the product of intelligent design, but it in no way follows from that they don't describe a reality independent of those laws. So you're committing a genetic fallacy in saying that because human beings have conceived of the idea of God, therefore, it's a made-up idea. It doesn't follow at all. Human beings could well have conceived of it, and it could well be describing an independent reality. Now, I don't agree with intelligent design in the way that it's mostly understood is basically a way of fighting with Darwin. Did the eye evolve, and did the dog and the wolf have a common ancestor, and so on? That's not my argument. My argument is that the validity of the intelligent design argument is completely valid when applied to the universe as a whole. And here's a very brief analogy to illustrate that. If you and I were walking on the street and we saw a car, an automobile, we would know immediately that it's the product of intelligent design, right? The molecules didn't fly up and all assemble themselves into a car. So that's the universe. Now along comes Dan Dennett, who says, wait a minute, I want to show you the wheels of this car. These are the different life forms. And I want to show you that one life form, in other words, the life forms can be produced without external intervention. They operate according to natural forces that are within the car, meaning within the universe. I would argue, so? The evolution of the part in no way refutes the intelligent design of the whole. So if the universe as a whole requires explanation, Dan says it doesn't need explanation. Even David Hume, the great skeptic, says we can never say anything so ridiculous as to posit an effect without a cause. So the universe, I would submit, with all its laws, does require some ultimate explanation. We would be really ignoramus as if we just said, well, just there. Imagine if you use that explanation for other things. The crater, it's just there. The dead actress who's been found in Hollywood, the head just appeared. No one really did it. No detective work is necessary. It doesn't need a cause. Well, it does need a cause, and if you're going to posit a cause, the most reasonable cause is to posit an intelligent designer that made it that way.
Hi, this question is for Professor D'Souza. You maintain that the Big Bang must have had a cause, as you've been going on and on. However, this, in effect, created the universe that is grounded in such rules of cause and effect. Yeah, at the same time, you also maintain that as humans, we are creatures of free will and choice, and then therefore are exempt from this universal canon of cause and effect. Does this not strike you as a gross inconsistency at best?
On the contrary, it is completely consistent with my supposition, let's call it a hypothesis, that a discretionary God who did not have to make the universe was not created out of necessity, it was created out of free, at least this is the Christian view, out of free will. We are created in the image of God, which means that to some degree we have some resemblance to God. In what way? What resemblance? Well, God's not a material thing. There's no Christian tradition going back to the beginning that holds God to be material. God's spiritual. So we don't resemble God in our material frame. That's why I have no problem with the theory of evolution, because I think that the material frame of man can be adequately explained by evolution. But I maintain that man also has a moral and a spiritual dimension. And while evolution has made pretty good headway in explaining what could be called low altruism, I scratch your back, you scratch my back, or the mother jumps in the burning car because, wait a minute, her children happen to share her genes, that's why she's doing it, disguised selfishness. This is all very clever, but frankly, it doesn't go very far. It accounts for about 10% of morality. If you get up and give your seat in a bus to a stranger, you know, Richard Dawkins may come and go, well, that was a very cunning move. You're hoping the old lady will give you her seat next week. No, you're just doing it because you're a nice guy. Or you give blood. Or Mother Teresa. Or give me liberty or give me death. There are lots of people who do things for strangers where they have no even disguised benefit. And I think evolution has not actually given a very plausible, it's given some implausible accounts of this, but it hasn't really accounted for morality. And I think it's that many people would admit that.
We're going to go till about 9:15, but in this segment, we're going to have each of the debaters respond for a maximum of 1 minute. Thank you.
Dinesh, the 10% that you think is explained, you're just not looking at the 90% of the rest of the work. You're offering caricatures of the work that's actually being done on the evolution of morality. And, you know, I've written quite a bit about this, and you can read my books and find there much more interesting, much more compelling, and more persuasive facts. It isn't all just you scratch my back and I'll scratch yours. It's not all just looking out for your genes. The work that's being done does promise to provide a complete account of the genesis of morality. That does not, however, provide an account of why, you know, which aspects of this we endorse. That is not a job for science. That's a job for a political discussion.
Thank you.
We've heard a lot tonight about the crimes of other messianic ideologies such as Nazism or communism, but I'd like to hear what both of the speakers think of Scandinavia, which happens to have 70% atheists or agnostics and happens to have the highest human development in the world. And why would we be opposed to acknowledge that, yeah, we had a Christian tradition, but we've moved beyond that and we take care of our own. They give the most to charity. They have the lowest crime rate. I mean, you could go on and on how they outperform America on just about everything, and they're agnostic and atheist.
I'm glad you raised that point. When I planted my hayfield some years back, my neighbor said, "Well, you want to plant oats as a nurse crop." I said, "What's a nurse crop?" He said, "Well, it comes up first and it protects the timothy, the hay." Then once the hay gets a good start, it protects it against weeds and against insects and so forth. Then you can cut the oats, you can harvest it as you want, but it's something that comes up first and provides a scaffolding and a protection. And I think of religion as a sort of nurse crop. I think that Dinesh is probably right, that much of what we value in secular 21st century America has its roots in Christian, for instance, traditions that helped to foster attitudes which led to the scientific revolutions of the 17th and later centuries that led to our principles of democracy and freedom and so forth. But I think we can be very grateful for the religious contributions to that. But now, I think it's time for us to grow up. I think we've outgrown the need for this nurse crop, and we can carry on in a secular country. And I think the Scandinavian countries are a perfect example of that.
I'm actually going to go back and read Dan's books, because I do want to learn more about the evolutionary arguments about morality, and I hope to learn from them, as I've learned from your other books as well. I do want to urge you to do something as well, and that is to take seriously an argument that was made by the philosopher Nietzsche. Now, Nietzsche is perhaps the great atheist thinker of the last 100 years. And he argued as follows. He said, there are many people in the West who want to have it both ways. They want to kill God, but they want to keep Christian morality. In other words, Christianity brought in things into the world that weren't there before. And Nietzsche, as an expert on ancient Greece and Rome, knew this. There was very little value in human life in ancient Greece and Rome. And the Spartans notoriously left the sick child on the hillside to die in the cold. So the preciousness of every human life, that's a Christian idea. Nietzsche knew that, but he didn't like the idea. The equality of men and women, or the equality of the races, another Christian idea. Again, Nietzsche had serious reservations about it. He thought that woman, for example, was inferior to man, and he has some of the most misogynistic statements in Western literature. So here's Nietzsche's point. Nietzsche's point is many people think you can kill God, but keep all those nice things that came into the world because of the Christian God. Nietzsche says that's an illusion. If you kill God, all those other things go too. And he predicted the 20th century would be a century of great wars, great conflicts, the fraying of the value of human life along the edges, both at the beginning, abortion, and at the end, infanticide, euthanasia. He said these ideas will all make a comeback. He was for it, but he was also prophetic. We have been seeing that happen. So I would just suggest that if you like equality, you like human dignity, you like compassion, be a little careful before pompously announcing, oh yeah, we'll cut off the roots and keep the branches and so on. That doesn't really work in nature, and Nietzsche argues it doesn't really work in civilization either. Thank
you. Yeah, thanks. And I'm sorry I have to pick on Christianity, but unfortunately, and I think it is unfortunate, the structure of this debate, it was in such a way that the advocate for God was a Christian. Anyways, my question is what sort of reasoning you can give for believing in or knowing that Jesus Christ, and I'm assuming that without Jesus Christ, Christianity doesn't hold without him. How can you justify that he's any different than John Fromm, which was a point that Dennett was making? And then to Dennett, my question would be, couldn't you just make the case that the belief in goodness, which you were talking about, is exactly God?
We have to be very, very brief.
Yeah, I think that goodness is what we need to believe in, and what we need to thank, and what we want to add to. And if God is as mysterious as many who believe in God say, then maybe God just turns out to be the human goodness that we have around us. It's super, and it's natural. It's just not supernatural.
Okay. Yeah. We're going to go to the next question, because we have to move on. Thank you.
My question is for the professor, and it has to do with the ethics of debate, and by that I mean the integrity that each debater brings to the debating table. At the heart of your case, you have charged Mr. D'Souza repeatedly with engaging in cartooning of your ideas, by which I understand you to mean that he diminishes the substance of your ideas so as to the more readily destroy them. My question to you is, when you then establish, when you elevate Stalin to the status of a god, have you then done exactly the very same thing that you charge him with? And in so doing, in the process of elevating him to the status of a god, is that a reflection of that growth and maturity that you advocated a moment ago for humanity?
Maybe you misunderstood my point about Stalin. Stalin took himself and advertised himself to be, in effect, a god, and built up around himself a pseudo-religious, quasi-religious, proto-religious set of institutions. And that was my point. I don't see that I was caricaturing anything that D'Souza said. No, but there are many gods that are not the god of which he's speaking. He didn't speak about Thor or Odin either, or for that matter, John Frum.
Thank you. Next question.
This question is for Dinesh. Earlier in your argument, you largely ridiculed both Daniel Dennett and most atheists as the caveman who stands at the end of his 2-kilometer territory and says, well, since I can't see anything else out there, it must not be there. And you stated that this was actually an impediment to human thought, or would be an impediment to human thought. But by stating that God is something that you can never truly understand and is outside of your experience, and therefore you can never truly understand creation or how the human mind really works, aren't you then the caveman that stands at the end of your territory and says, well, since I can't understand what made all that out there, I guess I'll never be able to understand and I shouldn't even explore it. And isn't that just as much of a hindrance to human, the forwarding of the human race?
Let's explore this more closely. Do you mind if I ask you a question or two back? In Would you agree that if we were to, for example, ask a dog, even if we had a way to communicate with it, to explain Newton's laws, would a dog be capable of doing that?
Communicate, then maybe, but not right now.
So you think the failure of the dog is merely one of articulation?
No, I think
not comprehension.
Isn't a creature that's capable of that kind of understanding, that level of understanding.
Exactly. All right. And you would agree that this is true of really every other creature, that in other words, there are limits to its ability to understand. Now, do you think that man, of all creatures, is exempt from all creation in that, to our knowledge, there is absolutely no limit whatsoever? Omniscience is available to us.
But should we be trying?
I'm not asking whether as an operational principle we should be trying. That's like saying that if I want to be Michael Jordan, should I keep jumping and trying to hit the net? Maybe I should. But my point is, if I said to myself, can I be Michael Jordan, modesty and humility and a recognition of my own impediments, including a bad hip, force me to truthfully say, I don't think I could. All I'm trying to get you to admit is, as human beings, there actually are some limits to what we can know. I'll state one. All the knowledge that we get is experienced through our senses, right? Do you know of any knowledge we can experience any other way? So our senses are like a 5-node tape recorder that are limited in comprehending experience, and no experience unavailable through those can be gained by us ever. True?
Except for our ability to reason outside of our 5 senses.
But even then, the data comes from the 5 senses.
I suppose, yes.
Okay. So right there, we've established a finite limit to human knowledge. Even though we can learn more and more, we will never be able to get beyond our 5 senses as long as we are human. We might have telescopes, but we still have to look at them through our eyes. We might have infrared, but we still have to look at that and measure it through our senses. That's my point, that as human beings, we should not be so hubristic. Of course we should try. I'm not calling for a ban on human knowledge. I'm simply saying that a recognition of our own limits, and this is Kant's point in the Critique of Pure Reason, reason should investigate its own parameters before declaring itself omniscient. We should do that.
My question is for Mr. Dennett, and it's relatively simple, and you can take this as you will. I'm just curious to hear your response. What, sir, if you are wrong? What if you're wrong?
I just wish that every religious person would ask that question too. I think that scientists and academicians take very seriously the question, what if I'm wrong? And I've devoted a great deal of thought to that in my own life and to my own work. And I look around me and I see religious people who are positively discouraged from asking that. They are told, don't even think about that. Trust your faith and don't ask that question. And I think that is the height of arrogance on the part of the religious community, not the scientific community. We ask ourselves, what if I'm wrong?
Thank you. Next question.
Hi, I have a question for Mr. D'Souza, which might provoke a response from Dr. Dennett. We're all reasonable people, and part of that is embracing all of the principles of rationality, including the principle of parsimony, which is if you can't prove something by either induction or support by deduction, that you don't accept it if it's a proposition that says something exists or something happens. So I could claim there's invisible fairies in this room, and the only way they interact with us is by tickling our pineal glands. But if I were to say this to you, you could rightfully ask me, what am I smoking? Unless I can provide evidence. So when it comes to the question of God, where is your evidence, or on what basis can you dismiss the principle of parsimony?
Okay, the principle of parsimony, as you stated, is that either something is true by definition, right, or it's true by empirical verification, right? And if it's not true based on those two things, it's false, correct? We shouldn't accept it. Exactly. So let's apply your principle to the principle of parsimony. Is it true by definition? No. Is it true by empirical verification? No. So let's throw it out.
Mr. D'Souza, you use this image of the rock rolling down the hill, which has to obey physical laws, whereas we, who are intentional beings, our decisions aren't determined by physical laws. Would you accept that neurons and the other aspects of the brain seem to obey material laws? And if so, why do you reject the notion that our minds, thoughts, and decisions could be determined by the same physical forces?
Wow, I'm given 30 seconds. Look, you're raising a very deep question about the way in which material things like neurons and non-material things like thoughts, feelings, and consciousness affect each other. I think you are dogmatically presuming that there is a one-way movement from the material thing to the non-material thing. I assert that I can equally plausibly show that there is a movement in the opposite direction. In medicine, there is something known as the placebo effect. For example, you're sick, you go to see the doctor. Now, your physical condition is already determined, right? You're sick in some way. And yet, if you think you're going to get well, even though you take no medicine, or you just take water, but you think that the water contains medicine, your mind is able to reshape the matter, and you actually feel better. So here is a practical example. By the way, one of the most widely tested examples in all of medicine. It's believed that 20 to 30% of all cures in medicine are due to the placebo effect. Here is a concrete example of mind shaping matter in very much the same way that you assert, dogmatically, that matter shapes mind. I agree with Dan that this is an unsettled matter. There's a lot of research going into it. I want to just deny at the end of this debate that religious people operate in some kind of self-satisfied certainty. I maintain that if you read the Bible, you read the book of Job, you read Christian theologians from Augustine on so, you will realize this is absolutely not so. Yes, there are self-satisfied jerks everywhere. On the other hand, the true Christian tradition is one of humility. It is one of questioning. It is one of being open to truth. I would maintain that questioning spirit of science is very much not only related to, it is in some way a product of Western Christianity.
I'm going to ask our last two questioners to ask their questions in succession and then give each speaker a minute and then we're done.
So my question is, first of all, I don't really believe that there has been equal dignity for women established universally. I think it's more legislative than actually socially or culturally established. But this is for both candidates, as has been said. But why are women almost universally excluded from the hierarchies of religion and decision making in religions?
Thank you. Ask the next question, please. Yeah.
My question is for Mr. D'Souza. One of the things you've been saying a lot is that everything has to have a creator, so like the car has to have a maker, the painting has to have a painter. Well, why is God exempt from that rule? Because if he has a creator, then we have to ask, like, you know, who's his creator, where did he come from, who created him? But if he doesn't have a creator, then how did he get there?
Thank you.
Answer either question.
I'll answer the first one. I think that the reason that women have in general not played those roles does have ultimately a biological explanation in terms of the way in which human cultures have evolved and in the way in which males have moved into positions of power and maintained them over the years. That's a long story, but it's also, I think, not very original. So I think it's a good question, and I think it has an answer if you consider religion as a natural phenomenon, as I do, and there's quite a literature on it. Now, anticipating maybe another filibuster to the left, since this may be my last remark, oddly enough, I'm going to say something that you won't understand, but somebody out there will. Dennett Singer, if you ever hear this, I've lost your address and I would like to reply to you.
Well, let me say this. I apologize if I've overspoken my time. Perhaps the reason most of the questions were aimed at me is that we're speaking in an audience where young people today are more naturally sympathetic to Dennett. In other words, if we were having the same debate in a church, most likely most of the questions would have gone to him. He would have every chance to filibuster. And also, he's here at Tufts. You can come talk to him tomorrow. You won't have me here tomorrow. So perhaps that's one reason the questions came to me. I think the one charge I do want to answer at the end here is just briefly this charge of caricature. And I want to say that it's, you know, I went back and I read Stephen Jay Gould of Harvard, one of the world's leading biologists, I think everyone would agree. And Dan's a philosopher, but I think he'd probably concede that Steve knows more about biology than he does. In his review of Dan's book, he says, he calls it a caricature of a caricature. He says that Dawkins has taken evolution and absurdly extended it into all kinds of other areas it doesn't belong. He's using evolution to explain economics, infidelity, laughter, law, literature, music, politics, war, why children don't like vegetables, why men don't like to ask for directions. This is, you can say, evolution run amok. And I think, quite honestly, it is a claiming of the prestige for science for making metaphysical and political claims that have nothing to do with science. So Gould used the phrase Darwinian fundamentalist. And what he means by this is not that Dan is a religious fundamentalist, but that he is making of evolution what the fundamentalists make of the Bible. The fundamentalists read the Bible, you may say, every human answer is in the Bible. And moreover, the Bible is infallible, and it can be extended to everything. This is, you can say, Christianity to run amok or taken in a certain kind of simplistic way. And the argument here is not over evolution, which I agree with, but rather, I think, over the extension of evolution beyond its parameters. It doesn't account for the beginning of life. It doesn't account, or not a full account, of consciousness, and it certainly hasn't given a full account of morality. It is true as far as it goes, but it doesn't go that far. So ultimately, if you want to be an atheist, you can, but don't pretend like you're doing it for scientific reasons. If you want to reject God, that is your right. That is your liberty. But on the other hand, you can't then say, I'm making this choice, but I don't want to live with the consequences of this choice. Ultimately, in Christianity, hell is not a place where God flings the unbeliever. No, ultimately, you say no to God, and God respects your choice. Ultimately, you may say the gates of hell are closed from the inside, which is to say your rejection is respected as your free choice. I want to thank Dan for sharing the podium with me. I certainly have enjoyed this very much, and I have tried to give it in the right spirit. Thank you for having me.
We have a closing statement from our organizer.
Hi. My name is Avi Molina, and I'm the Treasurer and Public Relations Director of the Tufts Free Thought Society. And the Free Thought Society would first like to thank Mr. D'Souza and Mr. Dennett for making their way all the way to this debate, for the sacrifices they made. Also, I believe Mr. Dennett lost some dinner reservations. Well, we just please give them a round of applause, and thank you for being here very much. We'd also like to thank just our sponsors and everyone who helped organize the event, especially Pat Andriola, who spent just countless hours working around the clock on this, the rest of the Free Thought site as well. And we'd also like to... we also have some gifts for the debaters. So we'd like to present to Mr. Dennett one Tufts watch, which you may proudly wear everywhere you go. And to Mr. D'Souza, we have a clock for keeping the time till the next debate. please feel free to purchase their brownies and baked goods outside that benefit persons affected by the Darfur conflict. You are welcome to make donations to the Tufts Free Thought Society to fund any other future events like this. There will also be a book signing here after the event, so if you would like to put their books outside that you can purchase, and if you'd line up along the edge, you could come to the table and have it signed. Thank you all very much for coming, and I wish you a very thought-filled evening. Thank you.